clock to another circle. And in that circle, you have relationships, or you can call it environment, but relationships works pretty well. Inappropriate relationships. Okay, that kind of behavior is not going to get us good relationships. The only people who are going to want to hang around are pretty sick themselves. Okay. So then, that, take the arrow back around to 10 o'clock, reinforces the poor self-esteem. And so it goes. Now, I had thought for a long time, you know what's wrong with this? A friend of mine who's gone through a lot of changes said that his wife, she hated these changes. And she said, anyway, I would never be able to catch up with you. And he said, what she doesn't realize is she's just a step away. Okay, and what I thought is that the transformational cycle is only a step away from the neurotic cycle. Okay, so we make another circle with those, with another model here, with those same little circles at 10, 8, 4, and 2. You start with good self-esteem, positive self-esteem, or sense of oneself. I mean, that's mainly it. Take it down to an attitude of trust, where we had fear in the other one. You've got trust. Trust in other people, trust in yourself, trust in the life process. I mean, that is a worldview. And from there, over to behaviors. And the behaviors that would come out of trust would be openness and caring and connecting and so on. So carry that on up to 2 o'clock, and there you would have transformational relationships. Mm-hmm. Which then reinforces your self-esteem. So you have these two kind of cycles, which are semi-hornized, my 12-year-old daughter and I made them up, as a matter of fact, out of conversation that we had. But it's real helpful, because if you look at that, you can see that you can intervene anywhere on that neurotic loop and begin to affect at least an oscillation into the transformational one. Man, I know recently drew it up as a spiral to show it in three dimensions, but in fact you can move in and move in and out. And I think what happens when we begin our transformational process is we are still mostly in our neurotic loop, but we begin to get more and more visits to the other one. Now, what Hornai said is that when you come into your therapy, and we will say in this case your transformational process, you come in with your neurotic conflicts. And it may be two examples she gave. One was a woman whose husband, she wants to be the perfect wife and the perfect mother. But her husband is an alcoholic who abuses her in front of the children. So what is she to do? Okay, the other one, example she gave, was the man who wants to be the perfect physician and the perfect family man. And his family wants to move to the country. And if they do that, he can't continue his advanced professional education that he wants to do. Okay, when we come in to the process of change, or in this case we think of it as the process of fixing, we just want to get that conflict resolved. The therapist usually has to pretend to help us work on that process, on that conflict. But her real mission, or his real mission, is, as Karen Hornay said, to undermine the neurosis. It's actually to find those, to point out the crazy assumptions in the neurosis and begin to undermine that. And to strengthen the real self. Because the real self never died. It's sitting there bound and gagged. But it's there. And it has its own agenda. And it wants out. So with a little bit of help, it starts getting out. And over a period of time, if the person doesn't get upset and threaten and leave therapy, this real self gets stronger and stronger. The neurotic self gets more and more undermined and discredited. And then comes the crunch. Because at that point, the conflict changes from what she called the neurotic conflict to what she calls the central inner conflict. And the central inner conflict is between the real self and the neurotic self. This is like the mythic battle. This is the Lord of the Rings. This is the last dragon. Because the neurotic self is terrified it is going to die. And it is. I mean, it's a very real threat. Its very existence as running the show is threatened, and it knows that. And who is this upstart? Because this other person, this real person that is emerging, it wants different things, and some of those things are simply not acceptable. And that is where we feel in our process of personal transformation, like we're going to die, or that we're going to fall apart. And that's why when we first start our processes, and I'll get into this more in a little bit, but when we first start the movement into our own transformation, early on sometimes it seems wonderful. Oh, I feel so much better. I start meditating, we've got peace of mind. Little bit do we know that pretty soon, if we meditate long enough, we're not going to have peace of mind. A little biofeedback for my headache, please. And what we don't stop to think about is when we get into the centered consciousness required to move the needle on the machine, the real self starts whispering secrets to us. So that agenda comes up. Well, I find this idea of the neurotic self and the real self and the final conflict, the central inner conflict, to be very valuable in terms of the personal transformation process. Karen Horneck, in the time when she was working, they basically had only classical analysis, and they had very few successes. It was discouraging. And if you read her books, you get real discouraged. And when neurotic people read her books and recognize themselves as being real neurotic people, they say, oh God, what's the use? They get an understanding, but they feel hopeless because she felt so hopeless. But the processes, the quick change therapies, and the technologies that we are working with now allow for people to have a different understanding of what they're going through. And also they're kind of sneaky in a way, in that we get into them more innocently than somebody going into a therapist. Okay, anyway, what I'd like to mention now in fairly briefly are these stages of transformation. The first stage that we go into, I call the entry point. And the entry point is not committed. The entry point is the first thing that happens to us that gives us an idea that there is something else. That, and for some people, it can be, the entry point can be kind of a long-term thing. It's not just a moment, not just a weekend. It can be becoming friends with a person who is really different from us and whose values are different and whose life is somehow appealing. That person is a new paradigm, in a way. It can be a seminar. It can be a book we read. It can be a spontaneous experience in nature. Almost anything can be an entry point. We deal with the entry points differently. You may, in fact, recall that you had several entry points before you had one that took. And you kept getting amnesia for them. Again, I think it's the anomaly. We don't know how to integrate this experience into our present worldview. So it's like the penicillin that showed up. Whew, you know, that was exciting. It made us nervous. It was so exciting that we got that change and quick forgetting. The entry point experience is like, for me, what it's like is a glimpse of what we can be. It's like, and this just seems like an appropriate place to observe that you've got a lot of clarity up here in Ohio, a lot of visual clarity. I mean, you can see. Mm-hmm. I live on top of Mount Washington in Los Angeles, and it's a wonderful view about 30 days a year. Actually, it's a wonderful view at night. But in any event, but there are about 30 days a year that there is no smog at all. And you can see all of Southern California from there. It's incredible. I mean, I can look out and I can see Catalina Island to one side and on the other side the San Gabriel Mountains. And they're enormous. They're looming. And I think, how can that be hidden from us at any time? How can something so big not be there? And those are the days that you feel really poignant about the smog. I mean, those of you who live in LA, isn't that when you feel really sad about the smog? Is when it gets clear and you think, oh, it could be like this. Well, I think what happens in our glimpses is that we get that experience and we think, what if it could be like this? Then the smog of our everyday life and behavior closes back in. And we either remember or we don't remember the clear day that we had or the clear experience that we had. And you don't have to go on from there. Another analogy that I have to what happens at the entry point is that on top of Space Mountain at Disneyland, there's an exit. You got all the way to the top. You thought you made that choice, but there is an exit. I mean, they give you a lot of outs. If you're pregnant, if you're fat, if you have a heart condition. But we know what the real thing is. We know why that door is there. You know what the bottom of it is. So you can leave from the entry point. If you don't leave from the entry point, the second stage I call exploration. And exploration is when you get on the ride. Now, it's an interesting thing about the exploration, you can tell this by its very name, is not really commitment, but it is, you've had it, okay? Because there's really no turning back. You don't know that at the time. When you've been willing to go on and look into this stuff, what you don't know is that once you have seen, you can't unsee. Someone on my staff recently went through a process where she had a very turbulent last year, in which she did several workshops, intensive workshops, got real breakthroughs in herself, and for most of her 34 years had been real irresponsible as a person, and then really got a sense of her own power and was working at a different level and feeling good about herself. And she got to a place that felt okay. And since the rest of her life had been not okay up to that point, this was wonderful, and she wanted to preserve okay. And what she wanted to do was to not see anymore. To just stay there. That was nice. It was a good place. It was better. And when she and I were looking at this whole thing in retrospect, after she began to get on to what she was doing, she said, you know, I tried all my old tricks of distracting myself that always worked for me, and they didn't work anymore. And I says, no wonder. It was too late for you. But the exploration phase is the one where we've now seen something we want and we're going after it. We have different styles of going after it. Some people say, all right, I'm going to pick the method. And this may have had to do with their entry experience. But I've got it, and I'm going to get advanced at it. I'm going to go for, you know, a terminal degree in cosmic consciousness. And so there's a kind of single-minded approach. And then others of us decide that we want to choose from the best that there is, and we'll make sure that we get the best. And so we try everything. And I have sometimes said that if there were a consumer report for us at this point of our personal transformation, it would do a wonderful business, because we could find out how much this transformation cost. Can I get my money back? Does it hurt? And
is it tax deductible?
Is it tax deductible? Very good. And we have the idea that we somehow are going to get the best way, go there in the best style, get more enlightened than the Joneses. And those of you here who have done AHP weekends, you know what that's like. And they say, oh, good, you've got 10 different workshops, 20 workshops to choose from. And if you don't like transactional analysis, you can go into psychodrama and you can go in whatever. And there is that broad exploration that goes on. Either way we go during this phase, we tend to be a real pain in the ass. Because for one thing, we now have the answer. Or at least the territory in which the answers are to be found. And we know that if everybody in the Pentagon dropped acid, the world would be okay. If all the world leaders were only runners, or did S, or TM, that's it. And so we're going to get all of our loved ones into this thing and a few people we barely like. You know why? Because they really need it. And we don't understand why it's so hard. I mean, you can usually get a few recruits if you're real pushy. But you meditated and you became one with the cosmos and you became this electrifying energy and it was incredible and they went to sleep. They wanted their money back. And you keep thinking, golly, I'm not explaining this right. I'll get somebody else to explain it. And so we buy them a good book, or we take them to a seminar, or we find some teacher that we think will get it across, and they're still not getting it. And we think they're being mean. They're stubborn. And they really did get it. They're just lying. They don't want to give us the seminar. What we don't understand generally at this point is the thing that the scientist with the paradigm shift has to learn, which is you don't talk anybody into a paradigm shift. That's not the key. That's not how it works, because it is not linear. It's just what it says it is. It's a shift. Now you don't see it, now you do. And that, for me, a way of thinking about it that is a useful analogy is those pictures in children's magazines where they have the hidden objects in the picture. And you're supposed to figure out where those objects are. When you see those objects, you see them all at once. You don't see them a little bit at a time. You get the whole thing, and then you always see that. But you don't talk somebody into it by first seeing this little part and that little part and the other part. There's a painting in St. Paul's Cathedral, a very famous painting that's been reproduced for a century that you've probably seen. It's a Christ knocking at the door. And they always point out to you when you visit the cathedral that there is no handle on that door. It can only be opened from the inside. And that is the way it is with the paradigm shift. That you can offer somebody an experience, you can offer them the information, but they have to be getters. That it's seldom that you can hit somebody over the head with something like that. In fact, even I think a lot of people have thought that surely you ought to be able to do that with LSD. And yet there are people who would verify that some people can take a major psychedelic and not be impressed in the least and totally forget that they had that experience and consider it meaningless. So, I mean, it is really a case of personal readiness and personal style. That one of the things that brings us to the end of this period of our transformational process is a recognition that people have to come in their own path. That all of these, first of all these techniques are the same on one level. Because all they are is just methods of waking up. And that everybody comes to their own waking up in their own good time and by their own path. And that you can't do it for anybody else, no matter how much you love them. It's just a really hard one. And it's especially hard because as you became involved in your personal process, you probably found out that there were a lot of people threatened by that. And they hated it, and they made fun of you. And what they don't realize, and this would be really nice if we could get this across in a piece of cultural wisdom. If somebody is going through a change process like this, the people in their lives will try to attack it. And they will think they will bring them to their senses. And they try to alienate the person from the process. What happens is it alienates them from the person themselves. Because once people get on this path, there isn't any turning back. And no matter how painful it is, it's rewarding. And so what happens is that the real separation starts to happen between the people. It's not that somebody is going to talk you out of your process. And even if they do it for a while, it's not going to last. And this is where a lot of conflict in relationships begins to escalate a lot. Because people, we're so misguided in a way in terms of relationships that we really think we can keep them as they were. We don't seem to understand much about the dynamics of that. And so when somebody starts to change, there's just a need to bring them back to their senses. And it's a very uncomfortable thing that starts to happen with the dynamics of the relationship are such that if you change, power changes in some way. There's no way you can change independently of the relationship changes. So that happens in this stage. the business about noticing that the techniques are really all, in fact, the same, and that, and not, and quitting making value judgments about what's better, is in part due to the fact that we become less attached to those teachers and tools and techniques. What tends to happen to us is that wherever we get our first important experience, we associate that with the process itself. Mm-hmm. And it's like if you were in a dim room and somebody walked in and they turned on the light. You tend to think that they are enlightened, or that the light is enlightened, or that the room is enlightened, or something like that is enlightened. You had no idea that there were other sources of light in the room, or that you could have found the light switch. And so you tend to honor them. Fortunately, most of these techniques are such, and most of the teachers are such, that even if you want to stay stuck in that idea, you can't. Because you pursue the technique long enough, and it will tell you that it's not it. And Buddha said one time that the techniques are a finger pointing to the moon, and once you've seen the moon, you don't have to keep looking at the finger. So that's one of the recognitions that ends this exploration phase, is that, in fact, this is your natural heritage. It isn't some weird and magical thing that happened to you, and that you don't have to buy the total dogma of whatever system you happen to get involved in when you first got involved. That you can do this in your own way, which is not to say you don't respect the technique or the teacher or whatever. When people come to an end of this period, there is, I think, between this one and the next, the most noticeable change, in that faces change, expressions change. I think one of the things that changes is that most of us carry a certain amount of tension around our eyes, even from childhood, that I suspect comes from our need to control the situation. It's an expectation that something is going to go wrong, and we have to be vigilant for it. Because I've noticed that there is a letting down of something around the eyes, that people, and if you haven't seen somebody for a couple of years and they walk into the room, from across the room, you'll say, they've changed. People who observe changes in face physiology and body movements have said that similarly there are actual physical changes that you can see. And I'm sure if we had subtle enough tools to measure changes in the nervous system, we would see some profound changes that happen there. But it's as if there is a moment in time, and I suspect that this is the central inner conflict. There is a moment in time when we make a choice. And it is, we will have made some commitments before then, and we'll make some commitments after that, but this is the big one. And I brought with me, because I just came across it again, a wonderful and often quoted passage that I'd like to share with you, by W.H. Murray. And I'd like to talk briefly about commitment before going on to the next stage of transformation. Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance, which no man could have dreamt would come his way. I have learned a deep respect for one of Goethe's couplets. Whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. There is a point where whatever self is our context looks at its own source and looks at its neurotic structure and recognizes the self for what it is, and that is not the same as ego. In fact, it's the opposite of ego. It's a larger self. Now, this is terrifying. A woman came up to me after a workshop in Maui to talk about this process of that central inner conflict for her, she said the scariest thing was when I saw my own power. Because wait a minute, what do we have to let go of when that happens? Now this is what the whole exploration was bringing us to, was this moment. I have to give up being a victim. Oh no! I mean, think what a comfort it is not to have responsibility in your life. So that's really big. Also, if I have this power, what's going to be asked of me? What am I going to have to go through? I mean, it's like in one of those great mythic stories where they come and they tell you, you're the guy who's got to go find the ring. Who, me? Where's the committee? See, we haven't really looked at that, I think, which is the thing that is the scariest to us, is to look at the fact that the self is not this jerk and is not a victim, but is powerful and creative. Because then that means we're going to have to live our lives in a whole different way. And we're going to have this nagging need for integrity. We're going to have all this stuff that we didn't. So there are a lot of rewarding things about being afraid and being a victim and having to protect yourself. Also, part of it, I think, I haven't thought about this before in quite this sense, but it's also very hard for us to give up on our judgments of other people. And that if, in fact, we have gotten this shift of perspective, which sees each of us as somehow on a kind of a karmic journey, I guess you would call it, however these people talk about it, then I can't know what those other people need and what they're going through. And, oh, that hurts to give that up. Right? I mean, you see, it's so clear when we are able to see ourselves as distinct from other people to know who it is we thought we were. Last year at some point I gave a talk to a group of pretty much left-wing filmmakers, and they hated it. Some of the people there hated it when I talked about people involved in transformation in business, and most especially in the military, which they hated. But business, I mean, it was like this one woman said, multinational corporations want power. There is no way people in those organizations can't want to control the world and victimize the world. And I talked to her about power because I began to see that she was looking at power like it was something. What would she do with it? She was projecting. So I said, well, if she had power, she would run the world the way she wanted to run the world. I mean, it was, and I also realized as she talked that I was threatening her because she knew who she was because she was not a multinational corporation. And if, in fact, some of those people had values like the humanitarian values she thought she had, then who was she? So there are certain things that we give up at this point and certain things that we take on that are really strong experiences for us. And a lot of people that I've talked to said that that they get really very much worse in this process before they get better. That there is a lot of, there's not a smooth transition for most people. I mean, I think there could certainly be exceptions to that. The next stage I called integration. And this is the one, and once we've gotten that insight or these kind of major discoveries, then we begin integrating that, because that really means applying that to all aspects of our lives. Because a lot of people, I think, when they get involved originally in their transformation, they hold it over here as a hobby. It's neat. It's a fun place to go to. It's Shangri-La. It's a game I play. What happens if we have to integrate it into our lives, into our value systems, into our relationships, into our work? You know, and so there is this period in which people try to understand, what do I do with this in my life? And also, how does it fit in the big picture of everything we know? And so people will start looking at the history of all this and begin to realize, well, over the centuries, over the millennia, people have had these glimmerings. How come nobody's ever gotten it together to have a whole society that lives by this? That's one question. The other thing people tend to do in the integration period is whatever part of themselves is incomplete, they work on completing that. So that if they're real right-brained people, they try to get more of a sense of organization and intellectual grasp on things. And if they're real left-brained people or real linear people, they seek out more of the heart. And it's like people who have never read anything but Edgar Cayce want to read the Tao of Physics, and people who've never read anything but physics want to read the Rig Veda, and so on. So there is this willingness to kind of move into unknown territory to try to complete certain aspects of oneself. A woman we have been doing some work with lately and wrote about, Sandra Siegel in Los Angeles, works with something called voice analysis. This is a parenthesis. And Sandra hears in people's voices harmonics that relate to, you might call it body, mind, and spirit. It's what she calls the physical, which are the lower vibrations that she hears in their voices, lower frequencies, and their physical and sensory systems. Then there is what she calls emotional or feeling systems, and then the mental or spiritual. And she says that we all have, or virtually all, come in with two of these harmonics that are dominant, and that our life's work is really to get the third one. It's very interesting, but that is the final integration. That is, and I think what happens to people in the integration phase is that they're seeking that part of themselves that they didn't want to have to deal with, or that wasn't their strong natural aptitude. The fourth stage is the one where people say there are a lot of, I've gone through these experiences, there are other people who have gone through similar ones that I have met. What if we worked together? This is the stage I call conspiracy. What if we began working together to try to make the world different, even just the world right here, different? And at this point, there's not that if everybody at the Pentagon did est or whatever, or five-year plan, or a sense of, quick, we got to sell this to the whole planet. There is more a sense of, we've got to do something, and it doesn't matter even if it's going to work or not. We have to do it. Like one of my friends says, it's the only game in town. You know, when people come up with all these reasons why transformation isn't going to work, you say, so what else is there to work on? What's the point of anything else? There's Richard Bach and I, when we met for the first time about a year ago, we discovered that we had both said something very similar in lectures the previous week. In essence, it's this. You know, somebody from the audience says, but what if all this stuff you say isn't true? And Richard Bach says, but what if it is? So that there is an awareness that your life transforms as you begin living in a transformed way. That's where the transformation starts. It starts with us. George Leonard said one time in 1974, so after his book The Transformation came out and somebody was attacking him for being such a foolish optimist at a time that the world headlines were so bad. See, people always think we have to wait till the world headlines aren't bad before we do this. And George said, I'm going to live my life as if the transformation has already happened. And a lot of my friends are doing the same thing. And when enough of us do it, it has. So anyway, this seems like a good breaking place for lunch, if my watch is right, 12:29. Does that make sense, Joe?
Okay. Okay. 2:03 in the morning, and in the worst rainstorm, two nights ago, this meeting, and it was really a rather miraculous, I hate to use the word encounter, because there was none of that quality to it, but coming together of hearts and minds. In the kitchen, which is the warmest place on the land. And at a certain point, I said, I just have to go to bed. So I proceeded to march out in my little Tibetan dress and my little Peruvian poncho without raincoat in my usual little, you know, Chinese dancing shoes. I mean, I'm from the South, and I've done it in Africa and South America and Middle America, and I don't know about these mug lookers or whatever they call it. You know, barefoot is it for me. So the idea of this heavy foot gear is absurd. So I'm at 3 o'clock in the morning in this driving rain, tromping through the rain up to the top of the road. And you know what the road's like today. Well, we have all that gravel because the mud was just amazing. No one could get up the road without aid of a ski lift. Plus, there were puddles this deep And I'm walking in these puddles with, you know, ohai clay lapping up my legs and my thighs. You know, and I, you know, slide down the hill to my teepee. And I'm standing outside of the teepee. And in spite of the fact we live rather close to nature here, there's a fastidious woman inside me who's always operating. And that's the one who has, you know, been to dead parties since she was a very young girl. And I said, I cannot walk into my teepee dripping with mud and, you know, get into my bed. I mean, that's a struggle at night. So I proceed. I'm one of the few people who has running water on the land, and that just means a hose in front of my teepee. And I began to drip every morning, and I thought, it's like the time I almost died in Mali. I had infectious hepatitis, didn't know it, thought I was getting old, and I'm lying in a thing called a hangar. Somebody's being signaled. Are you okay? And a hangar, which is a male's ritual shelter with a roof this deep of thatching. No woman is allowed to go in there except, you know, if she does, she has to sacrifice a chicken. So I was never allowed in there except that I passed out, you know, during this ritual, not from anything but from severe illness, and was carried into this hangar and woke up and looked up, and there was this sort of ring of black men, male faces. And the only thing that came to my mind, because they were all looked so concerned and so sweet, was, oh my God, if my mother could only see me. So as I sat there with this hose, hosing myself down with this super freezing water at 3 a.m. going on 4 in the morning in the driving rain, going, oh my God, if my mother could only see me now. It becomes the mantra of the absurdity of one's existence. Or the time, you know, several years ago when I broke my arm in the jungles of Ecuador and I'm sitting there with a callus fracture, both bones fractured, realizing it's a 5-day walk out of the jungle and laughing, thinking, oh my God, am I mother? It's the only way that you can get balance in your life. You were talking about your mother. I have one too. Really. In any case, let us disappear those mothers from our hearts and minds for a minute, in the sense of that upper dog mama. And, you know, a Buddhist teacher was here, a Tibetan Lama, said something which just absolutely moved me deeply. And, you know, there's a concept of reincarnation in the Vajrayana tradition. And in the initial teachings of the Vajrayana tradition, you come to the realization that all sentient beings have been your mother in one lifetime or another. And then there is doctrine about what our mothers do for us. Well, I won't go into that, but let me tell you, when I felt that from him, and I look out at people, you know, today or when Elizabeth last week when we worked together, and I realize that we've all been mothers to each other. And this is that quality of the mother that I want to bring through in my own life, to embody and to live that. And I want all sentient beings to live that in relation to me. That sense of hope really, you know, comes right out. Well, part of what gets the sense of hope going is when I sort of disappear the mother that I bring to fore when I'm playing the clown of, oh my God, if my mother could see me now, and bring this other mother through, which I do using chant. And I was brought up as a Presbyterian, so there's no possibility that I was ever given any support for my own vocal process, except and other such things. And what I discovered as an anthropologist, and Meryl and I were cackling like total hags here, because anthropology is an excuse for life. It is the most incredible.
Joan can do anything.
Really?
She can do drugs or anything.
No! I even have licenses, which allow me to do anything just in the name of anthropology.
You got to investigate.
Yeah, once I said to Jean Houston, we're two old hags, so I said, you know something, Jean? I said, everybody should be an anthropologist and everybody should go to jail. Okay, you'll understand. Anyway, that was profoundly.
Have you been to jail?
13 times. Okay. Saying, oh, if my mother could only see me. The time in Algeria was the least fun. Anyway, but I've also sat in front of the fire with peoples from corners of the world that I never dreamed of as a kid, but I realize are really accessible to us now, and we should get there fast before those corners are gone. Mm-hmm. and I just, it's funny, I have a book that just came out, and it's not available, it'll be out in May, but I read the last paragraph in the book, and my heart went, oh, I'm so glad I said that, because what I said, actually I want to show it to you, because it's just right there, that we're at the end of a mythological era that has persisted miraculously for 150,000 years, and this sense has borne across great geographies and incredible amounts of time and is now coming to an end. The Paleolithic barely expresses in what we know as anthropologists and archaeologists the great knowledge of the past, just the few little glimmerings that we understand. And what's extraordinary is that era is alive today on the planet. There are hunting-gathering peoples who still live as our ancestors did in Europe thousands of years ago and carry that condition with them. And this is the era of their passing. And it's incredible. You talk about thresholds. We are really on an amazing historical threshold. And it's, you know, when you say scary, I use that word, it's scary. It's really scary because it's our genes are changing too, you know, jumping genes. We are biotechnological mutants. I mean, when I was sitting in this rain and remembering talking to Northwest Coast peoples about the changes, the old men would talk about the changes in the weather pattern. Yeah. Well, Joel, 50 years ago, you know, it was like that, but now it's totally different. So we're interacting with nature in a way that is really profound. And we have a tremendous amount to learn. And part of that learning takes place, literally, in the fires of the ancient, around the fires of the ancient ones. And it's not that I'm espousing that we'd be atavistic, but there is a vitality in the hearts of the ancient ones. I mean, the old medicine men who come here and French kiss all the girls. You know, I just go, oh, God. And I say, I'm too old for that Don so-and-so. They don't care about that. They say, you want a direct transmission of life energy for us? And they aren't kidding.
Like I said, it might not look like we thought it was going to look.
Old man, 100 years old, and no fillings in their teeth, and they still got all of it. You know, it's we have something to learn from them, and they've got something to learn from us. And that's why they come here. Not because we're such nice folks, but because there's an exchange of information and heart going on that is profound. And part of the information they've, you know, given a real beginner, and that's me, is that some of the traditions and the ritual processes that they have done for thousands of years are really workable for us. And so one of the things that we do a lot here is chant. And we do it because it integrates what we feel are the sort of lower functions, the instinctual functions and the higher functions. When you think about food, for example, you can go for weeks without eating food, like, you know, rice or cabbage. You can go for days without water, but you can't go but for a few minutes without breath, air, prana. And it's a food for our body. And it literally is the means wherein we give fire to our body, and most of us aren't breathing. We are not, we are dispirited. We are without the spirit of breath. And what we're calling for is a means of inspiration, of bringing the breath in so our bodies can be fired. Because, and Joe Campbell said, I worked for him for years, and he used to say, well, Joe, the spirit is the perfume of the body. You know? Oh, it's, and he's 76, or he just turned 77, right? He swims 44 laps every day at the New York Athletic Club when he's in New York, and two laps are each for every card in the major arcana of the Tarot. And that guy is still, you know, writing and dancing and lecturing, and he just finished a week at, with Al Wong doing, you know, Myth of the Body, and comes here on Tuesday to do his stand-up amazement and never stops because he understands that the body is like this earth, is the temple for the exercise of the spirit. And part of that knowing comes through chant, because it really, through breath, the body becomes active, the cauldron starts heating up, the heart goes, wah, it really goes, moo. And when the heart opens, then the throat chakra, truth, number 5, can come through. And then that truth comes. And the truth comes in essence in chant, in an essence way that is, I can't describe it to you. You can only experience it, and you won't today, but it's something that you can take as a possibility away from here. And once that truth begins to manifest, then the higher centers can really come through clearly. Most of us have great ideas about spirituality and about love, but, you know, it's totally other to live the vision, not live up to it, so to speak, not have great ideas about it and have it drop down, but to come up from the ground.